Welcome to the Digital Leaders Podcast, Season 3.
Today's guest is Dan Such. Dan is co-founder and director at CAST and is also a trustee at NCVO, the National Council for Voluntary Organizations, and sits on the Charity Commission's Digital Advisory Group. Hello, Dan. Great to have you on the Digital Leaders Podcast.
Thank you, Robin.
So, before we find out a bit more about you, can you tell me about CAST, the organisation you co-founded?
Yeah, of course. So, CAST is a charity that's now just over 4 years old, and it was set up specifically to support social organisations to respond to the changes in our environment based on digital data and design, and to help charities ensure they can use digital data and design to achieve their charitable objectives.
And how's that going?
It's going really well. We're working with a whole range of charities, over 600 this year already, a whole range of critical sector bodies and organisations. And part of the way in which CAST was set up and designed was to work as a network-based organisation that can bring together these different partners towards that shared objective. And we've got lots of examples now where that's working well. We've still got more challenges to address, but we've got a great team working with great partners, and so far, so good.
And whereabouts are you based?
So CAST is actually a virtual organisation. It was set up as a network-based charity. It means we have a core team that are spread in from Spain and Jersey to Birmingham, Stroud, and some in London and Chichester. We come together every week virtually, and we come together every few weeks in person, and that's generally in London. But as a team, we have people spread across the country and parts of Europe too.
Tell me a little bit more about that, because there'll be lots of charities and non-profit organisations listening to today's podcast thinking, that sounds brilliant. And are there any sort of tips or things that make that work for you that not every charity would find works for them?
It's definitely been a process of discovering how best to work with a distributed team. More than that, it's been trying to work out how a distributed team works best when some of the team are co-located. One of the main things is that you recognise there's an information imbalance between how people share ideas, whether it's over a cup of coffee or whether it's a formal email or over Slack or something. And trying to figure out how the team can work equitably is the main challenge. So the main thing that we've realised is if more than one person in our team is not physically present, we all behave as if we're all logging in together. We're all virtually joining. And that process means that there's an equitable opportunity for everyone to be involved in the work that we're doing. But critically, because we're set up in that way, it means that as we develop new work, it means very quickly we can bring on new teams and new experts, even if they're not in the same location. And that just breeds diversity and new ways of thinking into the organisation.
It sounds really interesting. And presumably, is the reason you did this, was it to do with sort of keeping overheads down, and was it to do with lifestyle, or was it to do with trying to get the right group of people together and they just happen to all live a long way apart?
All three of those have benefits. It was certainly the last, which is how do we find the best people at the right time to work on the right problems and the right projects, and recognising that individuals' lifestyles and desires to work in different parts of the country or across Europe mean that we can't always work with the right people if we just focus on one geographic area. So the starting point is definitely how can we kind of form the right teams in the right way, and that means not having a specific base. And that does, of course, come with different sorts of overheads. We put more emphasis on, you know, really good network connection, really good microphones than we do on buildings and the like. But equally, part of kind of starting a network-based charity is recognising that there's going to be lots of times where we're working with others who are outside of the core CAST team. In fact, 60% of the people involved in kind of CAST work aren't part of the core CAST team. And that means we have to be able to very quickly build the right teams, the right relationships, and not having a geographic base means that we start off with an expectation that we can work from anywhere at any time.
And how does the back end work? So obviously you're receiving public funding, charitable donations, there's the Charity Commission. You know, this is a world in which reports, paperwork, recording, everything taking place, you know, really has to be on the mark. So is that something that one bit of the organisation has taken on, or is that done virtually as well?
It's absolutely done virtually, and I would imagine most physically located teams still use digital to help do that. But there's definitely a shift that we're not, you know, particularly interested in people's time on task, but it's more about how they're achieving key results and heading towards important outcomes. But that's one of the benefits of being able to work in such a flexible way, is we have a whole team of very committed, very focused individuals who bring a whole range of expertise. And actually kind of the one of the barriers or challenges of having such a remote team is stopping people from spending all their time doing this stuff, because it's so integral to who they are, rather than just kind of closing the doors at 5 or 6 o'clock. But we do take that accounting really seriously. The accounting is on the processes we use, the outcomes and the outputs that we're trying to create, as well as ensuring we work really effectively together and how we account for time together, time working on projects and the like. So we manage that really well, and hopefully in a way that supports us achieving kind of the goals of the organization, rather than just how we're accounting for people who are turning up at a particular time.
And it would be remiss of me not to ask you, on behalf of charities and nonprofits listening to today's podcast, what bits of software are you using to organize your team and your meetings and your projects, your outcomes, etc.? Are the two or three things you're using you would be recommending to others?
Yeah, absolutely. There are a number of kind of core staple technologies we use. One is the Google Suite, which is essentially all the kind of editing kind of software, essentially kind of slide decks and that kind of stuff. It also creates our shared drive for all the folders and files that we're creating. We use Slack an awful lot, which is a way of communicating within a team and extended teams as people join us, which means we intentionally have those kind of water cooler moments, as well as specific kind of project channels to discuss. We have an internal tool called Oka, which helps us manage all of our work towards our overall outcomes. And that's using a process called key results, or objectives and key results, which are a bit like targets and a bit like performance indicators. But it just aligns us slightly more to our theory of change-based approach. But it means that everyone can log the process, the progress they're making, and the learning that they're creating to share that across the team. But most of the tools like Trello or Miro, Slack and Google Drive are either free or low cost. And of course, we use Zoom like we are today to ensure that we can see each other as we're holding meetings.
Brilliant. Well, I'm sure there'll be some people rushing off to Google or research some of those products. So now I know you were at Nominate Trust when we first came across each other in the past.
Yeah.
But can you tell me about your journey, your early inspirations and beliefs that kind of led you to where you are now?
Yeah, absolutely. So many years ago, I was a primary school teacher, and I was almost forced to be involved in a technology project that was led by the University of Bristol, by the head teacher, who said, "You need to spend one day a week on this. We've got some funding. Can you please do it?" So with some reticence, I got involved. And through that kind of program and that research project, I got involved in research, in asking bigger questions than how do we just kind of deliver good education. And I started working with technologists and really thorough researchers and people from the creative industry, who gave me kind of new ways of asking questions and thinking about the work. And from there, I joined an organization called Future Lab, which was where I guess kind of some of my founding principles have really come from, which is about how can we use really good design and creative approaches mixed with emerging and developing technologies, and a real focus on learning and education to understand how we can better solve social challenges. And I think that kind of those three parts, learning and education, technology and design and creativity, have been the thing that have kind of seen me all the way through my career from there. I left Future Lab to join Nominate Trust, where there was an even greater focus of using those three things to see how we can support charities and socially driven organizations. There's also something really consistent from Future Lab, Nominate Trust and CAST. And that's working with Annika Small, who I co-founded CAST with. And I've been able to work with her for over 15 years now. So whilst wearing different badges for different organizations, there's been a real consistency in me being able to be led and understand what I'm doing, to reflect on my practice by working with Annika.
Brilliant. And Annika's obviously, Annika Small, very well known in the nonprofit sector, and in fact, a winner of the Digital Agenda Impact Award Person of the Year, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And rightly so. And I suppose if charting back my own professional career, I've been able to lean on all of her experience and expertise and kind of learn with her for such a long time that it's just, not only kind of brought me to these different organizations, but also kind of really shaped the way in which I'm trying to kind of emulate some of the work that she does and build on the platform that she's created.
That's fantastic. So in terms of that, what are you working on right now? What's filling your days? What's your key objectives?
The biggest piece of work that we're focusing on at the moment is something called Catalyst, which is at thecatalyst.org.uk. And it's a coalition of many major funders and foundations of governments, digital agencies, civil society bodies, and charities, trying to understand how we can create a more responsive and resilient social sector. And specifically how we can respond to the changes in behaviors, needs, expectations, and opportunities that digital data and design have brought about. It's quite an ambitious program, recognizing the challenges facing the charity sector and the challenges facing them in achieving their objectives. We think that over the next 5 years or so, we need the majority of the sector to have understood how to respond to the changes around digital and to start thinking about how they can use digital in their work. And Catalyst is the body to do that. It's this big coalition of major organizations, people who are really committed to a stronger civil society. And CAST is incubating that program and looking to help drive it over the next few years.
So it's sort of at arm's length to yourself, or you've said we'll set this up within the CAST structure and sort of run it and administer it? I mean, how many partners are there?
Yeah, so taking that first question, it definitely started off within CAST. Part of this network-based approach was trying to find a way of responding to the challenges of digital at the relevant scale. And so rather than building a core or a big core organization, we've always looked to bring in freelancers and partner organizations and others to work with us to achieve this mission. And so we've been testing out ways of working across multiple organizations. And Catalyst then was the realization that there are a number of different organizations that need to be involved in this if we're going to achieve the change that's needed at the scale that's needed. And so we've been testing it out. We've then been able to bring together other organizations who have a shared mission and to formalize it as this big program called Catalyst. Legally, it sits within CAST at the moment. And the transition from now is how we can incubate it so it can be something that's independent and can live without the CAST team running it. And at the moment, there are over 50 different partners active in work to do with the Catalyst. But there are hundreds of people and organizations who have signed up because they share this ambition of ensuring we have a really strong, responsive civil society and recognizing the vital role that charities can play in that.
So who are the core funders behind it that are putting the bulk of the money in, and how much are they putting in, and over what period of time is that funding kind of promised or secured?
Yes, the founding funders of Catalyst are governments, National Lottery Community Fund, Comic Relief, Paul Hamlin Foundation, Esme Fairbairn Foundation, Co-op Foundation, and City Bridge Trust. And they've all come together around this shared ambition to realise kind of the role of charities in creating a stronger civil society. The funding they put in, it lasts for about 2 to 3 years, and it's somewhere around £3 million. Now, recognising that we want to shift how support a sector to shift its behaviour, that's looking at 40,000 plus organisations. We've got enough money and resource to really kind of start this going. But there's definitely ambition amongst that group and amongst others to see this happen at a greater scale over a longer period of time. So the incubation period and the real focus from those founding funders is the starting point. And if we can test out ways to make this work really at scale, then I've got no doubt there's appetite to continue well beyond.
And what are the core activities going to be? So there's obviously going to be, I assume, some money handing out to be done. Creation of best practice, or are you building a platform?
A mixture of all of those. So there are a number of principles that kind of sit underneath this. The first is we expect the vast majority of things that need to be done for charities to respond to digital data design already exist. So there's part of the role of Catalyst is finding those practices, finding those organizations that are doing this stuff well and helping elevate them and share what they're doing across the sector. There's a whole set of work that's focused on supporting charities specifically to develop their practice, from those early stage charities who are just beginning to understand or explore the role of digital, through to those who are already beginning to kind of integrate it into their ways of working. There's also a whole set of activities working with funders to help them understand their contribution and the way in which they can support charities to do this well. And there's also a whole set of work working with agencies and support partners that provide support to charities and helping them do it in a more empathetic, more focused way. There are great examples, of course, already of all this happening, but we need to see much more of it if we're going to achieve these sorts of objectives. And there's also then kind of the bringing together of all the organizations who have these shared ambitions to see how we can do things better together. From there, we're identifying a number of things. Some work that already exists that just needs more resource or more time. And as you said, that's handing out money, either on behalf of or with the foundations that we're working with. there are some critical contributions that are lacking that could address some of the really consistent challenges we're seeing. And where they don't exist, we need to invest in those, and whether that's creating them or finding people who can create them through the Catalyst Network. And there's also then the sharing of best practice as we can see where these things are working both within charities and between them, how we can share that better so that more charities can learn more quickly so that as a sector we are more responsive.
Now, how has it been received so far?
So it's been received really well. We had a gathering in June this year where we started by kind of sharing where we got to. The thinking from CAST and all the partners we've been talking with as we've been designing this. And the first starting point was how can we help charities kind of respond to digital data and design, how they can use it within their practice. But the overwhelming response from the 300 plus people in that room was, this is our chance to rethink the role of charities within civil society. Not just think about how we use digital within our work, but to rethink just how important the charity's role is in shaping civil society and delivering kind of better change for the communities we serve. And so it's been received well. It's been kind of pushed further already. And now we've got a whole number of organizations that are already working towards these goals and many more who want to be involved. And I think over the next 6 months, that's where we'll really see with more clarity just how we can begin to operate at scale with so many people wanting to connect and align their work.
It sounds great. Who are the kind of leading figures? I know Martha Lane Fox, who has obviously been a sort of key figure in this digital space and digital society space
now
for a good 10, 11 years, was with you at that launch in June. Who else is kind of on the board or playing a key role?
It's a really great question. And I suppose I would kind of flip that a little bit and think about one of the opportunities we have with digital is how we connect lots and lots of people and organizations who are really passionate about this stuff. And the thing that excites me most about Catalyst isn't actually kind of the great figureheads. Of course, Martha and others play such an important role, as do the CEOs of the foundations and the leaders of the organizations we're working with. But it's small teams who are really focused, who are using really strong processes to solve complex problems. That's where the real energy and focus of Catalyst becomes real, I think. So we could kind of list a number of highly well-known and respected people. The real value for me is the small teams who are doing great work, and the small teams like Super Being Labs or Neon Tribe or Shift or Snook, and some of the charities like the Children's Society or Safe Lives, who have got really focused teams who are grappling with this stuff and then really openly kind of sharing their learning and their processes. Those are the people I think that we should be really spotlighting, because that's the new form of digital leadership. If we can connect that level of leadership, then we see a much bigger and much stronger response to the challenges our sector is facing.
Some of those organisations you've mentioned are relatively young and new, and I just wonder whether the sector needs to reboot itself with new organisations and new blood, and what your feelings are about perhaps charities that have been in operation for a long time, because there are an awful lot of them and they do obviously vary massively in shape, form, activity, size, turnover, etc. I mean, I suppose similar to the SME sector, which is huge in the UK and covers everything from a kind of micro one-man band business all the way through to a sort of 250 million turnover organisation.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So there's when we look at SMEs and the corporate sector, one thing that happens quite a lot is things end. And the things end because of the way in which the market operates. You know, products aren't relevant anymore, products aren't bought, or something else comes to usurp it. We don't have that feedback loop in the charity sector. So things don't end quite so easily. They don't end because they're not good. They end perhaps because they've run out of funding rather than because something's better than what they're offering. But we do have lots of kind of startups. We do have lots of new entrants to the sector, whether that be startups that are supported by Bethnal Green Ventures or new B Corps or new charities or new social enterprises. We have lots of new blood and lots of new ideas. And whether they are starting as traditional charities or whether they're starting as digital organizations that want to have a social aim, there's a really interesting kind of ecology of organizations who have these bigger shared objectives. When we look at some of the more traditional or older charities, there is something about that feedback loop, about how they receive feedback that what they're doing isn't quite right. That doesn't exist quite as well as it does in other sectors. But that said, there's also something really unique about established charities that startups can't emulate. And as an example, we CAST run an accelerator program called Fuse, which works with established charities over a very short period of time, about 3 months, to help them create new digital services. And when we look at the figures that have emerged from there, we know that new startups take between 5 and 7 years to get to the a relevant scale with a new service that has a repeatable income stream that's hitting the relevant scale of impact. And yet established charities can do that within 3 to 5 years because they already have the characteristics of growth that a startup are looking for. They have the reputation, the deep connections to the community, the deep insight into the challenge. And if we can fuse, hence the name, the startup processes, these digital ways of working, with the characteristics of an established charity, then there's something unique that we can provide that is better than a startup trying to do on its own. But of course, that challenge is really tough. The integration between these new ways of working and the established kind of processes and even kind of a structure of a charity aren't easy to fit together. But if we can fit that together, then there's some real value to be found.
Do you think there's a more of a movement now, particularly amongst perhaps younger people, for this sort of profit with purpose, meaningful activity, that they're looking for opportunities to make positive change? And it's a really important outcome for them, and that is leading to more individuals coming into the charity sector, perhaps for the first time.
We're definitely seeing lots more socially driven, mission-driven organisations that take a whole variety of organisational form that are starting up trying to address these big problems. And TechVGs is a great example. All these coders, developers, designers wanting to use their skills to address issues around migration and refugees, and using that in a way that brings really new creative ways of addressing these problems. They're actually quite different, though, from how the established kind of refugee migration sector are responding. And it's where those two things can be brought together that for me, is the most exciting. That said, there's also a challenge, or rather an opportunity for charities, which is charities almost literally by guarantee, by the way in which they're organised, are set up to solve a social challenge or to address a social challenge. And that's the foremost thing that they're set up to do. Any other form of organisation doesn't have that wholly as their foremost thing to do. They always have a profit motive or a growth motive alongside that. And there's something interesting where we see some of the scale of the tools that are being created by for-profit organisations that are incredible, and some of them provide such unique ways of addressing these issues. But at some point, they have to find a way of commercialising their work. And of course, that's not problematic. Charities have to find ways of becoming sustainable. But it's where that becomes at odds with the social value they're trying to create. And just to give you an example of that, if we look at the field of mental health, there are over 250,000 apps that have been created to support people to have better mental health. And in some ways, that's amazing. What a choice. It shows the speed of digital innovation, that anyone with those talents and technologies can create things like apps. They've been downloaded 3.2 billion times, which shows this really significant shift in people's behavior for looking for support and help, that 3.2 billion times people have accessed these tools. But the sad thing about that is 0.1% of them have any evidence of efficacy. They've always got no evidence to show that these are really built on insight and knowledge, especially from our sector where we kind of drive from evidence-driven or experience-driven practice. And 3.2 billion times people have said, I don't care. I'm using the thing that fits with my behavior, the way in which I want to find access, support and resources. And that those 3.2 billion times they've gone around the UK charity sector to find something that's been created in Silicon Valley or elsewhere. And so there is this challenge, not only in how much the UK charity sector's expertise is being left behind or in those 3.2 billion times completely missed, but also at some point, those tools have to then pay back their investors or find a way of kind of growing to the next stage, which puts a strain between their commercial imperative and the social imperative. And charities don't have that in any way the same shape. And so there's a really interesting challenge and perhaps a really unique opportunity for charities to help rebuild civil society by understanding how they can take a lead in ensuring we have responsible ethical technology.
One of the things we see in public sector and also in the commercial side is that the kind of the young guns, the hackers, the coders who really want to make a difference don't have the knowledge and experience of the activity that they're kind of working in. And often, particularly in the case of data and AI, you know, without the expert, the clinician directly involved in the process of coding and looking at data, you really lose something very important from that process. And obviously, a lot of the older charities do have real expertise in the topic that they're dealing with. And I just wonder whether, from what you're seeing out there, whether people are able to bridge the gap between the kind of the techie working on a solution and using their expertise to deliver something, but actually connecting with the trustee or the senior charity team member who has been working with beneficiaries for many years.
And that, for me, is one of the greatest challenges, that there are some really powerful tools and processes and design approaches that have been kind of demonstrated through the startup world that bring new ways of addressing these big challenges. And yet, if they're divorced from all that expertise and the reputation and the deep thoughts of charities, then we're losing something. And we do come up with things that align with people's behaviors and expectations. They appear, you know, as they want to at the top of the Google search and you know, the first thing they want to download, but don't have that expertise. Or we have the other side of things that are really well thought through, really well kind of often designed and implemented, but don't align with people's behavior because they haven't gone through that test-driven process. So bringing those two things together is critical. But we have examples of this working. I mentioned the Children's Society earlier on. They're doing this really well. Think about how they can bring together these design and digital processes with a really established old charity. Breast Cancer Care, or now Breast Cancer Now, working with Superbeing Labs to do the same. And there are lots of these examples of either doing it in-house or doing it in partnership with support teams, such as those that have been funded through the Tech the Good Fund at Comic Relief. We're beginning to see more and more of these examples where the best bits of a charity model meet the best bits of a startup model. It's not easy, but it's worth the effort because of the value that can be created when we get it right.
Now, one way in which the more traditional charities or the trustees can understand the value and the power of the digital opportunity that's been presented to them is themselves being able to kind of understand and grasp these digital changes. So moving on to kind of digital leadership, I mean, how important do you think it is for leaders in the non-for-profit sector to understand the digital world?
It's just critical to the extent that I think we've almost moved past the question of whether it's important to kind of what's the extent to which you can avoid it. But when we look at the physical high street, it's fundamentally changed over the last 10 years because of the way in which people buy things online, because of eBay and Amazon and PayPal. And that's changed kind of the look of the high street. The same things happen with people's behaviour about how they look for support, how they seek help, where we look for resources. And if we're not responding to the changes in the environment in which we're operating, then our organisations become less relevant. So, and I struggle to think of any part of our sector, even those that only deliver face-to-face services, I struggle to think of any part of the sector that doesn't need to respond in some way. The thing that comes from this, though, is some of the approaches that come from digital are the exact things that your really good boards do around risk management and minimising waste. The approach that comes from startups is lean innovation. And if there's ever a sector that's been so good with frugal innovation, it's our sector. When we look at things like Airbnb and eBay, it's about making more of the things that already exist in the world. Well, our sector invented asset-based community development. But we all these kind of things that are being brought to the fore by commercial companies through Digital Now build on so many things that we've been doing for years. And if we can bring them two together, then we can achieve so much. And so leaders of the organization need to certainly be aware of how significant the changes are, but also then start looking for people who can demonstrate ways of working within their organizations and outside.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. I mean, it's not without its enormous challenges, and the public sector and the private sector are still very guilty of boards and leadership teams not engaging with digital. Coming at it from a London bubble perspective, it's easy to think that everybody has got the memo and are working towards being a more digital organization. But equally, I think once you get away from the digital bubble, people haven't all signed up to this initiative.
It's a really great point. And there are some elements where kind of framing this as a digital challenge are right. One of the reasons for that is when we talk about digital, we're allowed not to know how best to respond, which gives us permission to try things out and ask for help. But digital also kind of masks the greater challenges which we're addressing. And by thinking about us as a small organization that provide face-to-face services, why shouldn't we care about digital? What it masks is the change in the behaviors and expectations of the people we try to support. It masks the shift in the environment in which we're operating, which is becoming increasingly digital. And possibly most important for charities, is it shifts where power is within the, within our country and across kind of the context in which civil society is operating. So when we think about the kind of traditional charity role of holding people to power, of championing those who are furthest from power, we need to think about where that power now is. And we know how much influence big tech companies have over people's lives. And if our sector isn't thinking about how that's affecting those within our community, or thinking of how it's affecting their behaviours and expectations, then we can't take that traditional role with us. But even for charities who are far away from the London bubble, perhaps even in Stroud, where I live, where they're thinking about face-to-face services, there's still that question of how is the world in which we're operating changing? Where is power? Where are the changes to the behaviours and expectations of the people we're trying to support? And then how do we respond to that? Some of those changes are very much because of the digital changes in the world around us. Some of the ways in which we can respond come from design and digital approaches. But I can't think of any organization where the changes in which they're, the context in which they're operating and the ways in which they can respond to that, then have some element of digital design and data.
So it's a fascinating topic, and we could probably talk for the next hour, I think, about the subtleties of going from, you know, shaking buckets to people tapping cards on at one end, all the way through to, you know, AI automation, data sort of transforming how you even think about the problem, yeah, let alone sort of what the current solutions might be.
You're absolutely right. And when we think of digital in those terms, it spans every element of our work, every element of the way in which a charity operates. In fact, one of the things that's emerged from Catalyst already, some work being done by Think Social Tech and Innovation Unboxed. And they did a piece of work to look at all the guides and assessment tools that support charities to understand digital maturity and what it might mean for them. So assessment tools and frameworks and reports. And I'll share the link with you after this, so you can share it with listeners. What emerged from there is there are 19 areas that count as part of digital transformation, 19 areas that almost all of these reports and tools have said you need to focus on. And when you look at them, it's not just the digital team or the IT department. It's every element from finance to recruitment to diversity to inclusion to engaging with new audiences to fundraising. Every element of an organization kind of shifts when you think about kind of the importance of digital affecting your organization.
And that's the digital transformation I think that digital leaders buy into, is that it's definitely not about the tech. It's about people and it's about the whole organization. And I really like the point you made about the power shift and kind of understanding that, because, you know, that cultural contextual change is always one of the hardest to implement. Final point, because we can't talk for hours on this, is levers you can pull in this process. Is it time for the Charity Commission to pull some big levers in the way that HMRC are insisting on tax going digital, you know, and other ways in which the people at the top, the trustees, truly understand that it's things are changing and have to change, rather than it being a good thing to change, things being compulsory?
That we're definitely getting to the point where there are more specific interventions that need to be shared with more charities. I don't know yet whether we're at the point that things need to be mandated. One of the parts of digital leadership for me is ensuring we take a really strong user-led, test-driven, iterative approach, which is tricky because leaders traditionally kind of steady the ship. But what we're asking for is for more people to be kind of running tests, to exploring the best way of doing things. I don't think we're at a stage yet where we know enough that every charity should be doing something to the extent that it should be part of the Charity Commission's demands. That said, I think that the Charity Commission and other important organisations should be leading the charge and saying, look, we know there needs to be some changes. We're going to help work with you to figure out what they should be. We're going to take a user-led, test-driven approach to identifying what best practice should look like. And at the point at which we have enough data to know what that looks like, then we'll start using the sticks and the carrots and the levers to get it into practice.
So we're still figuring out what it is we want to do before we figure out how we do it. So, go on.
I mean, just with that, one of the challenges, of course, is we're not saying there's been a big change in the world. Now we need to change charities. We're saying the world is changing rapidly. I know it's a bit trite to say it, but the way in which we respond to that is by creating responsive organizations. So building organizations that are based on testing, understanding the context, responding and trying to find new ways of delivering value within that context means that we're always going to be this in this place where we haven't quite got enough information to be confident enough, you know, that this is the one answer, because the context in which we're operating is changing again. That's why I think that rather than the charity mission saying this should be done, I think we need organizations like that to be saying, we're going to now continue to test and figure out what to do and provide the support and the guidance when we have the right answers or all the evidence for the right ways of working. But I don't think it's we won't get to a point in time where we have one answer. Even things like the charity digital code, which has emerged over the last few years, or the better service design principles, they're things that have started really well, but they will change over the next few weeks and months and years, as they should do. So seeing support from the sector as something that's also going to change to help charities deliver the change they need to is going to be a constant challenge for us to ensure that we are, to ensure that we're responding to that, we need organizations that can be responsive and resilient.
Brilliant. Okay, that's been a really good exposition of what needs to happen. So let's finish on our quick fire round of three questions.
Okay.
That our listener enjoys so much. So what one book would you recommend to our listener and why?
I listen to Audible all the time, so I'm constantly kind of hearing new books. So I would give lots. But the one that I most often recommend to charities and to senior sector leaders is The Startup Way by Eric Ries. He's the author that created the Lean Startup, which talked about these startup processes that kind of powered all these big kind of Silicon Valley technology products that we know of. But The Startup Way talks about how those processes can be integrated into established organizations. And it particularly identifies some of the challenges in bringing those two things together. So as a starting point for any charity thinking about how they can really adopt some digital processes, The Startup Way by Eric Ries.
Brilliant. Thank you. The one person I would love to have lunch with, living or dead, and why?
Oh, this is tough. I'd like to change the question and go to one of Babbage's dinner parties where he brought all these eclectic, amazing people together. But if it had to be one person, it would be Ada Lovelace. The lovely description of poetical science, of bringing the rigor of mathematics and science, the creativity of poetry and new ways of thinking, plus someone who was already kind of challenging stereotypes within society. I don't think I could keep up with her, but I would love to sit down and talk to Ada Lovelace.
Brilliant. And you've already revealed that you started life as a primary school teacher, so you've shared that one already. But the one thing that our listener would be surprised to learn about you is what?
So I'm a complete advocate of digital. I love digital and spend my time doing kind of exploring and thinking about it. But when I'm not in front of a computer, I make cigar box guitars, which are these handmade Depression-era musical instruments that are just beautiful ways to pass the time.
Wow. Okay. So as well as sending us that link, you're now going to have to send us a photograph of it. Just make sure I got this right. Cigar box guitar.
Yeah, check them out. They will. If we've got time, I was really struggling with a really big meaty project. Actually, it was part of Catalyst. I couldn't figure something out. And I went for a walk and ended up walking past the shop that sold these guitars. And the guy just gave it to me and said, look, just play it. And I resisted for a while. I hit a few notes and it just sounded amazing. And as I left, all the things I was contemplating just was resolved in my mind, so I could finish off the work. And since then, I've now been making these Depression-era musical instruments out of essentially any box I can find.
Fantastic. That sounds like great fun. And yes, we will have a photograph of one of these guitars so that people can understand what it is.
And we'll, sure.
Hopefully one that you've made, Dan.
I will make sure I send that through.
Brilliant. Okay, so sadly we are done there. We've run out of time. Thank you so much for being on the Digital Leaders Podcast.
It's been a pleasure, Robin. Thank you.
That is it for this episode of the Digital Leaders Podcast. Now, of course, we would love to know your thoughts. Tag us at DigiLeaders and let us know. And if you want to find out more about today's guest, head on over to our website, digileaders.com/podcast, and we have all that information there. That is it for this week. I'm your host, Robin Knowles. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll be back soon with another episode of the Digital Leaders Podcast.